Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. Hello listeners, welcome back to the show. I'm refreshed and revived now after spending a fantastic almost 2 weeks on the other side of the world in the tropical climates of Kona. Boy, did we see some performances out there, one of which was my old mate, Dr. Dan Plews, Yorkshireman, now residing in Auckland, winning his age group at the World Championships, which was his goal for this year, setting a course record time for his age group, 8 hours 24 minutes. That's phenomenal. I think he actually had the sixth fastest run of the day, including all athletes that were racing on that course. Now, Dan does have history. You know, I knew him when he was a young lad. I used to coach him, and his backstory is quite interesting. But that's not what today's call is about. Today, I'm joined by his his partner in crime, if you like, the prof of the Plews and Prof, Professor Paul Larson. So welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you, Simon. Yeah, great to be here. The better half, right? The better half.
Yeah, the better. Well, I don't know. Dan's from Yorkshire, so I don't know if I can ever say that anybody's a better half if they're not a Yorkshireman. But anyway, you've got the prof at the beginning of your name. He's only a doctor, so maybe on paper you're the better half. But
after that performance, I'm not so sure. I think he went up me on that one.
Wow. Well, what did you? I mean, you were watching that as well, Paul, and you've seen Dan's training over the last few years. You and he have collaborated on a lot of this. What did you think of that performance?
I was speechless. It was incredible. Like 8:24. It wasn't just winning his age group. He won like overall amateur, and he set a course record in Kona for all amateurs.
Yeah.
So just incredible. And that run, I think it was a 2:50 run.
Yeah.
He had everything on the day. I mean, I followed him through the preparation on Training Peaks and stuff. And it's there's no perfect preparation. There's always challenges along the way. So and Dan had those sorts of things. But I'm sure, you interview him, he might give you a little bit more insight into some of the things he was struggling with. But I mean, he came out just shining on the other end, and I was blown away, and I take my hat off to the man. I think it's pretty cool because he really does put his money where his mouth is, and he practices what he preaches, and he put basically all the science that he knows into practice, and delivered on the day. So super proud of the guy. Awesome.
Yeah, well, hopefully he's enjoying a nice rest now before. I don't know, where'd he go after that? I mean, that was his life's ambition, wasn't it? After he came here a few years ago and we first met in Kona, that was what he wanted to achieve. He's achieved it now. I doubt if he's going to step up to racing as a pro. So where do you go from there when you've smashed everything?
Yeah, it is the question everyone is asking him. I don't think he totally knows. I mean, that's everyone just basically says, yeah, he either goes pro or he retires. And I think he's more towards the latter than in terms of retirement, but I secretly wish he'd actually go pro. I'd love to see how far he could take it.
Well, he was, you know, when I first knew Dan back in the UK all those years ago, when he was a teenager, he was at Loughborough, and he was considered the next big thing then. Things didn't go quite right for him, and again, that's a story for Dan to articulate, but he had the potential then, and I'm really, really pleased that finally he's proved that he did have the potential. It's one thing having potential, turning it into delivering the goods is another thing, isn't it, as you know?
Absolutely. No question. Yep.
Now the interesting thing for me, Paul, and the reason that I wanted to chat with you today is that Dan has been documenting fairly in a great deal of depth this journey that he's been on with the low carb high fat nutrition approach. Now it's very popular at the moment. Some people might say it's a passing fad, and I'm hoping that you're going to say it's not, and that it's here to stay, and there's an awful lot of credibility behind this. But before we start talking about that, let's talk about your journey into this, because you have history as an endurance athlete as well, don't you? And it's not that shabby from what I've read.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, not in the plus standard at all, but I think my highlight was actually, it was after going low carb, high fat. I did my best Ironman performance in my life, and that was a sub 10 in New Zealand, which is a tough course. So I've had I go back, Dan and I joke, I was kind of in the, I would be called a semi-pro. So I was, kind of the top 10 in sort of the local events, you know what I mean? But never to Dan's kind of standard. But yeah, that was, I guess, the interesting thing for me was that when I was first meeting Dan, actually, we're both in New Zealand. We're at High Performance Sport New Zealand, the New Zealand Olympic program. I guess it started for me when, one of my mentors was Tim Noakes, Professor Tim Noakes from South Africa. Many of your listeners will know of Tim. And yeah, I was following him during his journey as he, I guess, was going on the low carb journey to, figuring out that was alleviating some health issues that he was having. And, I was, my late 30s and starting to go down, I guess, almost, having signs of going down having similar issues. I had high blood pressure. I had a little bit too much weight around my stomach. And, I decided to give it a try as well. And lo and behold, I got healthier. I improved my blood pressure, lost weight. And the cool thing was my performance improved. When I say my performance improved, probably the biggest thing that I noticed was that my long rides were getting so much stronger, and that I wasn't having to eat on the long rides. And that was pretty novel for me. I couldn't believe it. Usually whenever I'd go on a long ride, I would have to bring a bunch of food with me and pop a couple gels and eat a few muffins at the coffee shops. And now those long rides were just getting, you could ride for days. And that was, that was pretty profound. So I think that was my journey. Dan, of course, sitting across my desk he followed sort of shortly thereafter. And, from that, just always enabled us to keep tinkering and experimenting and learning. And yeah, it's been fun. So, that was really gave me the foundation. So I guess a little bit of, not just experience, but also, understanding and science. And we have the luxury of having metabolic carts, and we can quantify a lot of these different things. And your listeners are, if they're keen on understanding a little bit of this more, we've got a blog that's dedicated to a lot of these sorts of issues.
Well, and I mean, we'll come back and talk about this later, but there's a blog that I've alerted some of my readers to, which is the Diet and Ironman Performance, about appreciating the individual, which is interesting and makes some very, very interesting points. I'd just let me go back a little bit to one of the comments you made there, Paul, about you were following the traditional triathlon diet. You were eating a high carb nutrition throughout the week around your training. And you said you've got a bit more fat developing around your midriff. Now, this is one of the things that I've observed and other people have made comments about, is that you go to triathlons, you see all of these individuals that are doing quite high volumes of training in, maybe not in the triathlon circles, but certainly in relation to what the medical profession would tell us is healthy for, and yet they're carrying an excess of fat. Now, is that purely down to excessive consumption of carbohydrates?
No, it definitely wouldn't be purely due to the carbohydrates. That would be, and again, this is one of the things that we've learned. I would say that I used to think I definitely used to take that sort of reductionist approach. But I would say, there's always multiple factors. One of the other big players in that is our environment and lifestyle and stress. And that's, it has a similar mechanism though, and that is the fact that that stress causes for, you know, this stress hormone that you may have heard of called cortisol, which is it's defined as a glucocorticoid. So it's a that word glucose is involved, and basically it's involved with allowing a lot more sugar to kind of spill out from various places like the liver. And that's one of the sort of other factors. I think those are probably the two big ones, is probably carbohydrates relative to, you know, the level that you're sort of that you can tolerate. And then it's also there's loads of sort of other factors. It's, you know, it's calories at the end of the day too, right? So it's yeah, carbohydrates are certainly one of the players. In excess, they can become a problem in many of us, especially due to the sort of dopamine response that they drive. That's the signals of the pleasure hormone, and you can eat carbs for days, or at least I could. And they're not so satiating and whatnot. I think those are probably those are some of the big players that cause those athletes that we see that maybe are holding a little bit too much in the stomach area.
So, but you mentioned their stress and the response to stress and the sort of release of cortisol. And I guess that a lot of triathletes are also in high stress. They live in high stress environments. They have high stress occupations. They probably, you know, I know a lot of people think that exercise is a counterbalance to the stress they have in their life, but it's still a stress, and it goes into the same sort of sympathetic hormonal response. And because they're creating so much stress in their lives from the various elements, all of that goes together, and there's not enough balancing out on the unstressing, de-stressing, rest and digest side. So exercise plus diet is contributing to this. Am I interpreting that right?
Yeah, I think you are. If, again, we're always looking for that reductionist approach, and so we wanted to say it's this, this, and that. But it's, as I've gone down this sort of journey, is that it's complicated, and there's a bunch of different factors that are probably involved. Stress is a big one. Diet's another one. Exercise is another one. Sleep is a huge one. Sleep, you're not getting, you know, it usually goes hand in hand with the other ones, but if you're not sleeping well, that's it's another massive, contributor to the whole, cascade of stress and resulting, you know, body mass image and whatnot that you're kind of left with wherever you are today, whether that's good or bad. So there's a bunch of different factors. But stress is a huge one in all of that.
Interesting for me then as a coach to know that if I could encourage my athletes to train a bit easier, to change their nutritional approach, reduce some of the stress in their life, and maybe think more about recovery rather than training, we could use quite a lot of factors to turn them into much healthier humans as well as better performing athletes. And I know that's something that's significant in your in your website, isn't it? It's remind me of the three factors you have: health, something, and health, happiness, and performance. Is it?
Yeah, performance, health, and longevity. So those are the three key things that the Blues and I are mostly passionate about. So they do go hand in hand, I think, all of these different things. But it's amazing. It's one of the key. So both Dan and I coach, obviously, from that site. And lots of different high profile athletes. But what's one of the, you know, that we've got a good little, strategy of the key players that we want in terms of the training sessions that we want to have in there. But I think that's another big thing that we try to offer, is we really try to get our athletes healthy and having, working just as hard off the, you know, away from the training as they are on the training. That's because it's just, like you said, it's just, it has such a massive effect on their performance.
Well, and I know Phil Maffetone's quite big on this, isn't he? That, you know, you have to start off from a health perspective. We hear lots of triathletes now in the UK, this is their time of year to start their winter training, but they're asking for programs, but saying, can I can I hold back on the running for a bit because I've got an injury, or I'm on some medication at the moment. So they're not entirely healthy when they're starting that training program. And trying to get healthy when they're adding more stress in is actually going to be much more difficult.
Yeah, yeah. You got to start with the health first. And so much easier said than done. But and I think, you know, exercising is probably it de-stresses us as well, right? So it is good to get, you know, get out there and do a little bit of something. But again, it's context specific. It will depend on the individual and their injuries and their overall sort of state. But yeah, you're looking to get into some sort of nice cycle where you're getting a regular dose of exercise, the right nutrients to build a healthy athlete, and you know, good sleep and de-stressing periods in the day, and good sleep, which is part of that.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit about the low carb, high fat thing then. Firstly, I introduced this idea to an athlete, right? This is somebody who's been training a while and following the traditional methods of, you know, maybe a threshold approach to training, a carb fueled approach to training. And they're driven by the idea that unless there's research evidence to prove that this thing works, they're not going to change. And one thing I know is there's perhaps not quite as much evidence to show that this works as there is to show that a carbohydrate-supported training program works. So how would you've been doing the research, so how would you counter that in terms of the number of papers that are out there that support this particular approach, the low-carb approach?
Well, it really depends on where you want to look and what you want to believe. So many times, right? You could build a case for either side of the argument, you know, but you know, it's funny because I'm a scientist with, you know, nearly 150 publications to my name. And the longer I go on, the more I become more like a coach, and I'm really, I guess, of the belief that we just don't know. There's, you can't take a single paper or even a number of different papers and know for sure that it's going to necessarily work in a certain individual. I really believe that it's kind of almost down to a little bit of sort of trial and error, and maybe some science can kind of guide us in some different things. Now, the low carb approach to performance is taking, you know, it hasn't sort of had first dibs on the scientific lay of the land. And, you know, there are other factors as well in play that have caused for a larger, you know, amount of, I guess, evidence to be gained on the more carbohydrate weighted sort of side. But I always say context is everything, and you know, you have to look at who the subjects of the study are, you know, what they're actually looking at. It's very difficult to really look at, you know, you, the human being, and all the different things that you need in your stage of life, depending on your genes, where you are in your age, and your overall current sort of situation, just you that's right in front of me. So my answer to the question is that it really depends on where you want to look. Now there's more and more studies in the low carb, high fat that are coming out, and they are showing, you know, again, strong evidence benefits of recovery. Things like, you know, the I guess non-inflammatory effects of ketones, ketone bodies. And these are something that your liver produces when it is kind of trying to convert something into a fuel that your brain can use, basically. And these have, I guess, a lot of analgesic sort of anti-inflammatory sort of properties, and which can potentially, you know, enhance recovery aspects. So, yeah, I mean, I could start, you know, we've done some studies on this as well, and there's massive individual responses and whatnot as well that are out there. But the main things are the recovery benefits and I guess the performance and, you know, things like what, you know, Dan Plews is doing, the fact that he can kind of go out there and do these sort of prolonged rides without any carbohydrate and, you know, again, hit actually quite large power outputs. But the adaptation is not quick. It's not a quick sort of fix. It's, again, that's another player for why we haven't seen a lot of these studies as, you know, in the, they haven't been kind of published because they take so long to do. It's, you know, you don't see some of these effects until it's, you know, it's a month away. So, yeah, I don't know. I've been, a bit long winded on this response, but it's, I can't pinpoint a single study that I'd go to tell you, but there's more that are amounting and more that will continue to amount. But yeah, we should get to the individual effect pretty soon though.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing for me from my observations and of, you know, some of the stuff that you've been doing and conversations we've had and that I've had with Dan, what I've observed athletes experiencing is that, you know, a study of N equals one is perfectly valid in this situation. If it works for you, it seems to me that it works for some people better than it does for others, but there are benefits for all people there. And I can't actually see any downsides to trying this. You know, if you feel a little flat by following this nutrition philosophy, then it's still probably going to make you a bit healthier. It may not just add to the, add to your athletic performance, but for most people, health comes before performance anyway. But if you try it and it works for you and you're one of the outliers that gets a huge response to it, then the changes could be awesome from a whole host of different angles. And I don't personally see why you wouldn't want to experiment with this and see what's going to happen. Would you?
Oh, no. I mean, definitely. This would be, so if you haven't experimented with this for a good, decent amount of time, you definitely, this should be one of the things that you put on your list of things you want to trial. It all starts kind of at the, you know, at the supermarket and possibly changing, you know, what you put in your trolley. But yeah, the effects are profound. And again, you know, just go onto our website and look at some of the guys that are doing this. I mean, you know, Kyle Buckingham, he's, you know, winner of Ironman South Africa. Jan van Berkel won Ironman Switzerland. You know, look at Dan and his 8:24. So there's certainly individuals that are out there that are, you know, they themselves can't believe the effect that it's had on them. They're very open and honest about the fact that it's taken them, you know, a month or two to adapt to it. It wasn't, you know, it's not an overnight fix, but the long-term effects are just, they can be massive. So well worth the pain and in the short-term pain to get the long-term gain, I guess.
This, just going, rewinding a few minutes, you mentioned the recovery benefits and reduced inflammation. And this is something that I hadn't really picked up on until I was chatting to Phil Maffetone actually recently. And, you know, when we talk to people, somebody was asking me about how they recover better from an Ironman and what foods could they eat to help with their recovery. And I'd listened to this discussion and thought, actually, maybe rather than thinking about the things we should eat, maybe we can talk about the things we shouldn't eat, because I know, and you'll have seen it, Paul, but in Kona recently and in other Ironman races, that when you've done a long distance race, whether it's ultra running or you know, long distance swimming or an Ironman, you want to go out and eat all those things that you've perhaps not been having while you've been watching your weight in the lead up to the race. And so the next day you go and gorge yourself on high carbohydrate products. You have some pizza, you have some cake, that's from the bakery. You maybe have a few beers, all of those carbohydrates that are going to add to the inflammation and cause your muscles to be sore and take longer to recover. And actually, if we continued with this sort of clean eating style for a few more days, our recovery would be out of this world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and again, context is everything. It's just probably depends on the individual. So I think that, you know, a guy like Dan, who I know had a, you know, I think he had a nice beer and a couple slices of pizza after his Kona record. He's probably not going to be too affected by that with depleted glycogen stores and those sorts of things. But so, you know, in the acute sort of setting, it's probably not a big deal, but it definitely, if you're not carbohydrates or insulin sensitive and you're gonna have all those effects that you just mentioned, where you get the inflammatory sort of response that's happening.
So what I'm picking up from this, Paul, and what's apparent in the article we mentioned, you know, the diet and Ironman performance, which I'll share in the show notes, is that it really does depend. There's a whole group of individual circumstances, and the response to this, both long term and short term, is you mentioned this word context on several occasions, is different for each person, and we really don't know how people are going to work or how much effect it's going to have on those people. And within your article there, you have several different examples of people for whom it worked really well and for whom it didn't work perhaps quite as well. Can you just expand on that, on some of the surprising things that you've found as you've gone along in your studies?
Yeah, absolutely. So this refers to the blog that I'm sure you can link to. It was titled Diet and Ironman Performance, Appreciating the Individual. And this was written in response to a case study that was published by my colleague and Inigo Majuca from Spain, and his friend and my former athlete, Enrique Llanos, is a very famous Spanish Ironman triathlete, who I had the privilege of coaching. And it really kind of stems from that. Now he's a vegetarian, and he openly, gave permission for both Inigo to publish the case study in the International Journal of Sports Nutrition and Exercise Metabolism, as well as myself to write the blog post. So thank you to Enigo for that. The general gist is that Enrico and I worked very long to try to basically, give his body time to adapt the LCHF diet in the vegetarian context. And to make a long story short, we just had a disaster of a year. We had really poor performances, and he never really got there. You know, he tried that diet for a good 6 months almost, and it just never really worked for him. And I guess the big question for me was why didn't that occur? But at the same time, also, I developed a very big important perspective for the individual, and that's why I wrote the blog post, is because I can't say that there's a one size fit all solution. That it's not going to work for every single individual. For like the LCHF diet it might not be for everyone. And especially when you consider a guy who's tried it for that long, and then you also, of course, you wonder, well, what are the individual factors for why that didn't work for Enrico? Was it his genetic making? Was it the fact that it was in the lacto ovo vegetarian format? Was the fact that he wasn't getting any meat in his diet an important player? Are there micronutrients in the meat? And then, what did it, or did it have to do with his age and the fact that he'd basically, like all of us, possibly kind of abused carbohydrates for, up to his 40 years of age. So I don't have an answer, but I have an experience, and it's certainly an experience that makes me really, appreciate the individual. And, I guess it was almost a little bit of a shot in the ego, because I was a big believer of the fact that the LCHF diet might be for everyone. And I found that maybe it's not.
So let's say we have somebody who decides to adopt this style of nutrition, and they make those changes. You say that they need patience, but let's say they've been on it for a couple of months and they've been noticing that things have been getting better, that they're able to go out on longer rides and runs without the requirement for so many carbs, or even zero carbs, once they've once they've got over that little psychological hump as well. But are you suggesting that they should follow a really low-carb, high-fat diet year-round? That I've heard conversations about carb cycling and how that would might come into the training plan when you're doing particularly heavy training loads, or do you believe that one can actually exist on a low-carb, high-fat diet throughout that sort of change in training volume and intensity?
Yeah, so what you're referring to is the periodized approach, and I think that's, and there's so many ways to skin nutrition, right? Like nutrition is a highly, highly complex because it, there's so many different things that we can eat, and there's social factors, and there's food around us, but generally, the thing that we find works well for us, and there are published studies on this approach. But it is this periodized carbohydrate approach that you're referring to, where you'd have for example, high intensity session days, key sets, you would have your, you'd be consuming your carbohydrates in those sessions. And those could be, any form of, carbohydrate that's might be a simple sugar, like a gel, loads of ways to kind of skin it. But, that's generally something that we might promote. I think that's generally what we ask our guys to do. And that way they're also used to, we call them being we say they're metabolically flexible. They could almost they can consume either type of fuel. And, they're able to actually, consume carbohydrates during their actual races. Cause we say we want to train low and race high. So, it's almost like practicing for your racing, by doing those key sessions in a train high sort of situation.
There's a question that one of the members of my Facebook group have asked, is where does the 60 to 90 grams of carbs per hour actually come from? And should, if you're following a low carb, high fat approach, do you need to try and aim for that? Or if you are more metabolically flexible and you can work at a high power output on the bike, for instance, fueled just by fat, can you, during a race, if you accept that you're going to have to take in some carbohydrates, can you actually get away with consuming less carbohydrates than the 60 to 90 grams?
Yep, you bring up at a great point. And I'll go another place first with that. One of the reasons probably why the 60 to 90 gram carbohydrate came about were these things called multiple transportable carbohydrates. And a lot of these, basically it was a glucose to fructose, ratio, I think of 2:1 and, two parts glucose to one part fructose. There were a bunch of studies that basically showed that if you were consuming gels at that sort of ratio or, carbohydrates at that sort of ratio, you were able to get more carbohydrates into the system. So that's all fine and good. But one of the other problems with that is that, and this is also well studied, is that you, and we all know this, was when we have too many carbohydrates, especially in an Ironman type of race, you get this bloating in your gut, basically stomach issues, and which can be actually quite painful. Well, this is actually a lot of the reasons why many of these athletes, drop out of these races. And that's why they kind of come to us is there something I can do about this? And this kind of answers your Facebook followers' question in the fact that yes, there is, but you can, if you are LCHF and fat adapted, you can diminish that amount of intake, and you can bring it down to probably closer to 50 grams of carbohydrate, which might be more tolerable for your gut. I guess sort of almost take the gut out of the equation because of the, you know your effect now on these long rides. As a result of that, you don't have to rely on that, 60 to 90 carbohydrate kind of recommendation. You can really tone that down, and it helps definitely from that perspective, almost more than anything.
I also had this theory, Paul, that when you're doing a test in the lab, and I've done some of these, I've never experienced one where they've asked you to swim for an hour first, and most of the people that I know actually don't start to get stomach problems until they get off the bike and start running. And most of those studies that I've seen don't have you running for 2 or 3 hours after you've done the bike. So they're basing the carb, I might be wrong here, but it seems like they're basing the recommendations purely on biking at a certain power within a sterile setting. And what they also don't do is include the stress that comes from race day. You know, so if I said to you, we're going to do a 5-hour ride, but we're going to do it with 2,000 other people and we're all going to be jostling for position and it's a race, you feel a bit nervous there. Whereas if we're going into the lab and we're just going to sit on the bike and pedal for 5 hours with somebody taking bloods every 15 minutes and giving us a bottle to drink out of, it's nowhere near as stressful, and therefore your gut isn't already in turmoil. That's my layman's interpretation of sometimes why the research is a little bit flawed. It doesn't replicate those true race situations, and so therefore you have to find what works for you. And it certainly worked for me. And I know, you know, echoing what you've said, of reducing my carbs down to 40 or 50 grams per hour.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, the term, I think using the science term, is the lack of ecological validity in the study. And you just nailed it with the fact that, yeah, they don't actually do these sorts of studies on a, you know, in an actual race sort of setting. And they're valid only in the context of how they're actually conducted, which isn't 100% specific for the reasons you just mentioned. So yeah, it's spot on.
Cool. Okay, Paul. Well, look, I've had you on the show for a while now, and I'm conscious of the fact that you've got other stuff to be doing over there in Canada. So I've got some questions for you. If we can have a go at answering those, some of them you've probably partly answered. But Tim Byrne asks, he said he's been following low carb high fat for a month as one strand of improving his lifestyle. I've not had to measure its success at the moment, apart from the scales. But he's asking, what yardstick should he use to assess its overall effectiveness for him as an individual? So can you briefly give some things that he can use to test that?
Yeah. So I think there are a lot of the things that we've probably alluded to. The very first and foremost, how is he sort of feeling? And, you know, does he feel like how are his feelings of hunger during the day? So if it's working well, you should almost kind of get to that state where you almost feel like you don't have to eat. And and that almost allows you to do some of these other things like intermittent fasting or time restricted feedings, which is the situation where you might just have a large dinner and then not even sort of eat. You might not have breakfast and you might not even eat during the day. So that's kind of my situation. I haven't had breakfast and I'm just kind of a one meal a day kind of guy. So that's one thing, is the feel. And then the second thing, you should actually start to have, you should look pretty decent in the mirror. Like you should be able to look in the mirror with your shirt off, and you should, yeah, start to see some abs kind of forming and whatnot as well. So this is suggestive that your inflammatory fat stores, or if you had any, is kind of leaving the building, so to speak. And then the other big one is performance, as we mentioned. So performance on long rides, that should build, so that it's just performance on long rides and long runs. It should just be, feeding should not sort of be an issue anymore. So it's like you can start a ride or a run anytime and not have any fear when you leave the door that you actually, you know, you need to have fuel on you, or you need to have already kind of fed before you leave. And that's how I used to feel that way. So I'm sure there's some out there that appreciate that too. Those are almost kind of the big ones. If you want to get really technical, you could probably, you know, and you could also, you know, measure your morning blood glucose, and then that should be, you know, your morning resting blood glucose, and that should be sort of in a, 5 millimoles. You could even get more technical as well and start to measure your blood ketones, and you should see your blood ketones rising up above 0.5 millimoles of beta hydroxybutyrate. And then you could also even measure like your breath ketones as well, your levels of acetone. So hopefully there's a few things there that you could, you could go on.
Well, that one last answer there, talking about measuring your bloods, brings me nicely onto the next question, which has also come from Tim. It was a little PS. He said, another thing I've been wondering about, I've grown up with the mantra about not eating too many eggs because of the cholesterol, but he said not to eat too much red meat, keep the fats from nuts to a reasonable portion. With low carb, high fat, much of that seems to go against the grain. Sorry, pardon the pun there about the grains, mm-hmm. but what are the long-term effects for our other aspects of our health if we're eating more fats, or are these just unproven urban myths?
It's a great question. It's one I'd actually say we don't really know the answer to. But it was, you know, I think there are some general myths that are out there with respect to cholesterol. Certainly the level of dietary cholesterol does not have any bearing on, to my knowledge, on your level of circulating cholesterol. So there's, they're just sort of two different things. So you've got cholesterol sort of systems that are within the body that are going to, I guess ideally your liver is going to be keeping your level of cholesterol at a homeostatic level, or level. So if you, it's really kind of, I think it is in general a myth with respect to, you know, eggs. I don't think there's, you probably can't get too many eggs as one sort of example. It's not something that you want to sort of really keep an eye on in general, at least to my knowledge at this moment. And, you know, things are changing in this field all the time, but there's it comes down to the individual, but yeah, there's probably no, there's no alarms that you have to have if you're eating a somewhat varied, substance sort of diet. And you might even see as well, there's people that are almost the all meat diet as well. So there's a lot of individuals that's all they're having these days. And they are maintaining, some level of, health parameters in certain individuals that are following that are very good. So again, this kind of comes down to that same individual, thread that we've had throughout this whole podcast is that, you need to sort of figure out a little bit about what works for you, but, probably no general alarm bells necessarily going on, but it depends on probably what you're having around it too. Like, there should be a fairly colorful plate that goes with some of that, those eggs and meat products. And again, I'm a big believer that it's probably, you need to be considering the health of that animal product that you're consuming as well. There's going to be a difference probably between a highly processed animal and one that is, you catch yourself. but again, there's still so much we don't know.
So, for instance, if we're eating meat, we might want to be choosing grass-fed beef rather than corn-fed beef, as an example, just because of the balance of omega-3s and omega-6s that might be in there.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be my belief. I probably can't really add too much on that, but. Yeah, the health of certain products that are the highly processed, like you said, the high levels of omega-6 relative to the omega-3s is another whole big issue. So, yeah, again, in my opinion, you want to be probably, if you can afford it, that's a whole other issue. The working towards having more of the grass-fed and organic type, meats in your diet.
I mean, this is a question for another conversation, for another podcast, perhaps, but I've been of the belief for a while now that, yes, I accept that if you eat better quality food, it's more expensive, but it's an investment in your health. And if you spend on that now, it may cost you less later on in your life when your health is still robust and you're not having the effects of poor eating and all the other stuff. But that can be controversial, I know.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, like you said, you can pay now or you can pay later. At least that's a philosophy you can take. So, yeah.
Right, Paul, we've got one question left then. So Isabel Ross Edwards asks, she's heard that it's the best thing ever for weight loss and performance while others don't get on with it well. So we've discussed that. But her question was really wanting to know if there's a specific ratio of fats to protein to carbs as part of the macronutrients when you embark on a low-carb, high-fat regime. Thank you, she said, in advance.
No worries. There's different types of levels that you can kind of get to. And there's different definitions, and you can define it in terms of percentages. But I think one of the easier ways is to really to look at the amount of, generally speaking, the amount of carbohydrates that you're getting in terms of grams. So that could be like, 50 grams a day is often one of the markers that people kind of look at trying to get. Can you get below 50 grams a day? And when you do, you tend to reach that level of ketosis. So this is when you your liver will start producing more blood ketones. It makes that out of fat, and it needs to do that because it needs to have a fuel that your brain, your central nervous system, can use. And these are the components I mentioned before that have a lot of great energetic and potentially anti-inflammatory properties. So there's no hard and set rule, but that's a good marker to kind of go for, is to shoot for less than 50 to 100 grams of carbohydrates overall. You can't mainline fat, so you don't want to do that. Again, you can get you can gain more weight if you're having too many calories. If you're not losing mass on the LCHF sort of diet, or not getting to the body composition that you want, you really do have to look at what's the number of, nutrients that you're putting in there. But again, the main benefit should be these periods of time when you should be able to go for without food. And that's usually the best, the reason why it gets its sort of effect. And in terms of the protein, there's different schools of thought on that as well. But in general, the protein can also turn into carbohydrate through the process of gluconeogenesis. So if you're having an excess amount of proteins, then that's also another potential way that your body could, not be being effective potentially at the whole LCHF sort of an adaptation thing.
Did you have a figure for protein there, or?
Well, I really have an actual figure in terms of the grams that you want, but it's like you do have to watch your protein consumption. If it goes too high, then I forget the marker, but if it goes too high in terms of the protein content in the diet in the day, it can kick you out of ketosis. If that's the goal of your dietary regime. So you need to be cautious about having too much protein in your diet, is the general gist.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I've heard figures of 1.5 grams per kilo of body weight, but I know that varies depending on the training you're doing and whether you're male or female, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we should call this podcast really the It Depends podcast, shouldn't we? Because I think that is a lot of what we're talking about here. Is there's so much individual variation in terms of gender, age, DNA, life history, environment that you live in, sporting health, life goals that you really have to. And I think that is one of the big lessons from. The blog that we've talked about is you really have to find your own path with this experiment, find what works for you. But there are certain guiding principles that you've discussed here that we can start with and then see where it goes from there.
Awesome, Simon. Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. Absolutely. You got to figure out what you are, your own N-of-1 experiment. So observe what's happening in your body, follow some of these general principles, give things time. Try to make smart choices based on all these things.
Fantastic. Hey, Paul, I really appreciate you being on the call today. I know you've got a lot going on over there in Canada, and clearly you'll be having lots of people interested in what you're doing now with Dr. Plews, his performance in Kona. So I really appreciate your time. So thank you for joining us today. Is there any parting shots you'd like to leave with, or do you think that last sentence summed it all up?
I think that, yeah, I think it did. I think it's all really comes down to the individual. And again, all of, all the best to all of your listeners and followers on their own individual N01 experiments, and good luck.
Okay, well, that was Professor Paul Larson speaking to us from Canada there. He's in the Rocky Mountains. Before Paul leaves, I'd just like to say thank you to him. Also, listeners, thank you for being with us today. I appreciate that you have other podcasts you could listen to, so I appreciate the fact that you come back here each week and listen to the guests that we have. And we will be back next week with more amazing guests to speak with. But for today, from myself and Professor Paul Larson, thank you very much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your week. That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today, and I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. You could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon and 20 years of coaching, I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com, and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.